Yeah, so we originally started looking for an airplane during the pandemic time. Back in, 21, 22, we were doing operations in and out of China. You know, it was a quarantine situation. You had to go into quarantine, and it could last up to 3 or 4 weeks if they decided to. Anyway, it just wasn't economical to send crews over there. They literally were locking guys up in hotel rooms, and guys were going insane. I mean, to the point where they would spend 2 to 3 weeks in a hotel room without being able to leave, coming out and saying, I'm never going to do that again. So the way to solve that was we started doing wing-to-wing transfers. Like, we'd fly an airplane into China, crew would get off that airplane, immediately get on a chartered jet that was sitting there waiting for them, fly them out to a country like Cambodia, Philippines. So those charter rates, I think started out around maybe $20,000-$25,000.
Yeah, for like an hour flight, for like an hour each way.
Yeah, it was crazy. We thought that was crazy money, but then they started getting up into like $70,000-$75,000. At that point, we're going, wow, we could own our own airplane for what we're paying for these charter flights. And then we went, why don't we just own our own airplane?
Ready to go flying?
Yeah, I guess.
Something different.
Yeah, definitely something different, man. We've owned this thing for a year, and we're finally getting around to flying it.
Yeah, well, I've flown it once in a year. Hopefully we'll fly it a lot more in the next year.
Yeah.
Remember, the first thing we looked at was like turboprops and citations. I already had the citation type. Obviously efficiency was the most important thing. And then we found out that China has like a part 91 weight requirement. So like the airplane, it couldn't just be like a 12.5 jet. It had to be, I don't remember the exact number. I think it was 18,000 pounds.
The low rider.
I like the low rider.
I know, everybody says it's ugly.
I don't think so. It does look like a piece of construction equipment. Like a backhoe loader. The shovel
this
on it.
This is a blue-collar jet.
We set our sights on a west wind, and we started looking for one. And, we went and looked at, three or four.
I know, man. It's kind of dirty
everywhere.
It's got like a cockpit door. I kind of like that. Bye. I'm gonna. Yeah. Uh oh.
We've got a friend in Dallas that, he's kind of the West Wind guru, and he knows where everything is for sale, and so he put us in touch with somebody, and we ended up making a deal on that airplane.
Not a bad little machine.
Yeah, it was at the end of last year. It was like this time last year. Actually, right, almost exactly this time last year, because we basically needed to get it closed by the end of the year for tax purposes. And so we were scrambling right at the end of November to select an aircraft, inspect the aircraft, put an offer down, set up escrow. The whole process. I mean, all things considered, buying an airplane is a pretty complicated endeavor. And we got it done in maybe 3 weeks start to finish, I think.
As soon as we closed on the airplane, ready to go do what our plans were, China ended their zero COVID policy and opened up everything.
So now we have an old retro airplane.
kind of like a DC-9, really.
I mean, it really is. It definitely gives me flashbacks to the DC-9.
Yeah.
Our Israeli-built IA-1124A West Wind II rolled off the assembly line in 1986 and was one of the last five built before the model was discontinued in favor of the Astra. The rugged and reliable jet is a real workhorse with a nonstop range of over 2,000 nautical miles, speeds on par with any modern airliner, and a service ceiling of 45,000 feet. Dollar for dollar, there's really nothing else out there with the same level of capability and cost efficiency. There's exactly one West Wind simulator left in the world, so the training options are very limited. We do all the initial and recurrent type training on the actual aircraft, and our plan for the week was to train for a few days, then be signed off with type ratings after a check ride with an FAA-designated vintage type examiner.
This is your audio-visual wipers, AC and avionics power.
Yeah.
You got engine, fuel system is all here.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically this, you got heats and your master and generators, right?
Yep.
So it is somewhat compartmentalized, but not real tidy. All your, you know, all your circuit breakers are all compartmentalized as well, right? It's electrical, power plant, you know, instruments, autopilot flight director.
We spent a few weeks reading through the systems and training manuals beforehand, but there's no substitute for hands-on training. These days, the bulk of my flying is in Boeing and Airbus types, but flying this thing really brought Bob and I back to our roots in the DC-9 and MD-80, and we both love that about it.
All right, so talk me through a start.
Yep, so master on.
Yep.
Put
avionics stay off for now until everything's started, okay?
Well, you can put your AC on, because if you don't put AC on, you won't see your oil pressure.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So we'll put some AC on.
Yep.
And go ahead and alternate on your boost pump.
Great.
Hit the start, push it, hold it for 2 seconds. It's good.
And then at 10, 12, and I can introduce.
Yep. So undo the lock. There you go. Take it up and back. Good.
And warm it the last time. I guess the engine was still that hot inside, yeah.
So you see your oil pressure's coming up.
Yep.
ITT's well below. You can hit 900 at tops.
Yep.
If you see it popping past 8, you better shut it off.
Okay.
Obviously, as ferry pilots, Bob and I bounce around between different airplane types all the time, so we're inherently better prepared than most to absorb type-specific info with relative ease. That said, most modern Boeing and Airbus aircraft are very similar from an operational perspective, and getting into a vintage jet was definitely more of a challenge at first than I had anticipated. But despite its complex looking and relatively disorganized switch layout, I found the airplane to be somewhat logical, and as the training days passed, the hunt and peck nature of the switch flipping became more of an organized flow as the plane started to feel like home.
Forward pressure or no? No, I'll have the tops and the tiller.
Okay.
And so I'm going to give you 60 knot call, 80 knot crash check, and then you take the tops.
Okay.
And you can rudder should be up then.
I love this thing.
Oh, me too, man. This is a cool-ass jet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the low rider, but, I mean, look at this thing. This thing is so comfortable back here. It flies awesome, and it's got so much power.
Yeah.
I mean, videotape this takeoff. It'll just
it's unfortunate that we can't get that feeling of being pushed back in the seat. But this thing pushes you back in the seat. I mean,
you can if you sit there and hold the camera. No, it's got tons of power, especially light. We only have I think we have about 1,500 pounds of fuel right now, so not a ton.
I'll get Maz's take off, and then I'm going to come back. I want to see what it looks like down here.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should go land at another airport and get some cheap gas.
Is it expensive here?
I think so.
For Roswell, for when we go do this Roswell ferry, you and I should, me and you, assuming we're done, should ride up front together so we get used to that with you, with him on the airplane.
Yeah, definitely.
You know?
Yeah. Have a babysitter.
We definitely need a babysitter, man.
Yeah. We're going to get used to it real quick. It's just, it's not a Boeing, it's not an Airbus, it's something totally different.
It's a Jew canoe. Can I say that? I'm Jewish, I can say that.
You can say it. This airplane definitely supports Israel.
All right, let me go video this takeoff. Yeah.
Over the course of a few days, Bob, myself, and our friend Maz took turns in the seat learning the aircraft and practicing for our type rides. The weather cooperated the entire time, and we didn't have to venture far from the Dallas Metroplex, running between Lancaster, Redbird, and North Dallas repeatedly. The time flew by, but we spent so much time in the airplane that all of us really started feeling comfortable quickly. Because the aircraft spent so much time sitting in the hangar over the past year, we also had concerns that a maintenance issue could surface, throwing a wrench in the plan, but it never did. Nomadic 1 held together perfectly despite the beating we put on it that week, and that did a lot for our confidence in our decision to buy it in the first place. When we came down to Dallas to do this training, we packed for about 2 weeks knowing that there was a strong possibility we'd end up having to leave right from there to go ferry a big jet, but really had no idea where or when we'd need to leave. Originally, I anticipated having to roll over to Tampa to take an A320 to Indonesia, and figured Bob may head to China to move a 757, but a couple days in, a completely different project green-lighted and required us to get to Roswell, New Mexico to ferry an A320 to France. Just the type of mission that this jet could simplify. And now, the pressure was on to finish up so that we could fly ourselves to Roswell.
We're out here at the Redbird Airport in Dallas, and just doing some training, just refueling now before we go back up. And just been doing some V1 cuts today, some instrument work.
Training in any aircraft, be it the tiniest Cessna 152 or a Boeing 777, requires practicing things that take you way outside the normal envelope of point A to point B flying that we do in the real world. Full-motion flight simulators reduce the cost and safety risks associated with these maneuvers, but with no sim available, we do it all for real. Doing touch-and-goes in the pattern in an overpowered pocket rocket was so fun. I don't remember the last time I smiled so wide while piloting an airplane. It was likely on my first solo when I was a teenager. Of course, we practice plenty of instrument approaches, but the air work is definitely more fun. Stalls, steep turns, unusual attitudes, emergency descents, and engine failures in the jet flying around Dallas was a blast. Of course, we don't actually shut down engines in training, but we do practice engine outwork with one engine pulled back to idle, and we do this on takeoff, en route, approach, and go around. It may sound scary, but the reality is seeing single engine operations in real life is great preparation for the real thing should it ever happen.
Once I finally got that landing picture in my head, it's easy for me to kind of just like go into into the west wind mode, go out of the 757 or whatever else.
Yeah.
It's kind of what I do. I kind of just compartmentalize. Once I'm in a cockpit, my brain just kind of changes to that aircraft, kind of that sight picture and everything else.
There we go. I'm going to touch that.
That's a good one.
Good.
It's like you did. Those are our tires.
Check ride day. We arrived at the airplane around 9 a.m. and got our sign-offs and a final briefing from our instructor before heading up to North Dallas to meet up with the DPE.
Big engines. Yeah. And then it goes to a walk around. So they want to make sure that you got O2. They want to make sure you got your fuels and oils checked, your battery power, all the stuff that can kind of grab you before you even go to the outside.
Yeah, okay.
As you can imagine, the check ride was all business, and I wasn't about to roll cameras during it. But to summarize the experience, it was exactly as we trained. We did a systems oral together with the examiner for about 2 hours before flying, and then Bob and I took turns in the hot seat performing the standard maneuvers, emergency procedures, and a variety of precision and non-precision approaches. The process took most of the afternoon, but we managed to both successfully add our 12th type rating before sundown. With new temporary certificates in hand, we returned to Lancaster and I opted to rest in the comfy seats as Bob and Jason operated the final leg.
We finished our tights now, and it's about 5 p.m. and we're heading back to Lancaster Airport where the airplane is currently parked. So Bob's up there flying with Jason. And I'm just chilling in the back, and just happy to have it all behind us now. We're official. That's number 12.
I'm gonna go fly our plane.
Got kind of crummy weather.
Crummy weather here today. We're gonna fly to Roswell and pick up an A320.
Yeah, I guess Mother Nature's gonna put us to the test today.
Yeah.
Had to go grab another mask. Our mask had a leak, so we're borrowing one.
The big day had arrived. Bob and I were kicked out of the nest, ready to put our new skills to work on Nomadic One's first duty assignment, getting the two of us to an Airbus A320 ferry to the south of France from, obviously, Roswell, New Mexico. The cost of fuel in Lancaster was $1.50 per gallon pricier than at Redbird, and being the misers that we are, we did a quick literal hop 12 miles across town for the fill-up.
All right, we're at Redbird Airport now in Dallas, and we're taking fuel where it's a little cheaper, and then we're going to head over to Roswell, which is actually only about an hour and 20 minutes away, and we're going to get our first taste of doing this ourselves.
Set 20 for takeoff.
Yep. And trim the descent to the nut.
Ain't no de ice. Seatbelt, no smoke. Air, taxi, brakes, nose wheel steering checked. Flight instruments. Same headings.
The weirdest part about flying the west wind is how low you sit to the ground. We're used to taxiing seated 20 feet above the pavement most of the time. In this thing, it feels like you're on the ground. On 757s and all the wide bodies, we're 50 to what feels like 100 feet above the pavement when the wheels touch down. In the flare on the west wind, the thing is so low I swear I feel like I'm going to go underneath the runway like I'm in a poorly rendered PC flight simulator from the 1990s.
There we go.
Yep. All right.
One of the things I really like about the plane, the tiller. Taxiing with your feet is something that you grow out of early in your career as a pilot. The tiller on the west wind is a simple round dial that fits nicely in your left hand. It's got a high and low sensitivity setting, and neither take much pressure to get a response from the double nose wheel below.
Set. Speed alive. 80.
I'll I'll tell you what, the thing may look like a toaster or a minivan, but it sure doesn't fly like one. It's fast. It's no Citation 10, but it's no Citation 550 either. You'll blow through 250 knots on a quick level off if you don't chop the power, and she'll do 7.7 or 7.8 if you want her to and cruise in the high 30s. I'm not sure if it would ever reach its service ceiling of 45,000 feet, but she certainly has no issue getting up to 36 full of gas with a payload.
Yeah, it's a cool airplane. I think it's fun to fly. It's nice and smooth. It's not burning an excessive amount of fuel. It's actually fairly efficient for an old airplane.
For quick down and dirty fuel planning, the Westwind burns on the average 1,400 pounds, roughly 200 gallons of fuel per hour. Without factoring winds, that's a tad more than 2 nautical miles per gallon. It's definitely not cheaper or cleaner than driving by a good margin, but it's 7 times faster and it can cross water. Roswell is actually one of the few places that we frequent where it actually makes sense to use the jet. There's only one commercial flight per day in and out, seasonally two, and you can only get there from Dallas and on a regional jet. Flights are outrageously expensive, often $1,000, and an extra day on the front or back end of a trip there waiting for that flight costs us the same as the extra cost of using the jet. We had a 757 flying into Roswell a week after this trip, so we decided that leaving the jet sit there for a week was well worth the convenience of being able to avoid the overnight on that next trip. And frankly, we were looking for an excuse to play with our new toy and make a cool video, so the decision was made to fly the Westwind. We got prior permission from the FBO, AvFlight, to park the plane there for an extended period of time, and they advised that the cost would be minimal if we bought at least 200 gallons of fuel from them. It was clear as to why. Smaller, busier airports can charge hundreds, even thousands per day for a parking spot on the ramp, but Roswell has no shortage of space, and we were the only bizjet on the ramp, at least that day. We covered the engines, probes, and inlets and chocked in before catching a ride to the other side of the airport where the France-bound A320 was waiting for us.
Well, here we are, man.
Yep, we're in the fishbowl.
Yeah. And you're not a pilot either.
Yes. No, we're both pilots.
Oh, you are a pilot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we are the pilots that are flying it away.
Okay. Do you have your badge by chance?
Yeah, I've got an ID here. ID will get you anywhere in an airport.
Here we are now at the A320 here in Roswell. Scheduled out in about 45 minutes. Yeah, we're running slightly behind. There's a couple of faults they're trying to clear. But we'll be heading to Bangor here hopefully soon. It's about 4 hours over to Bangor, about 4 hours up to Cap, and about 3 hours to Montpellier, France, which is where this one will end. Kind of came up quick last minute. Bob and I weren't planning to do it, but we're in Dallas and it made sense, so here we are.
This A320 was a midlife specimen that came out of service with a now-defunct Colombian low-cost carrier, Ultra Air, which ceased in March of 2023. This was the first plane in a two-ship project which our client, the lessor that owns the airplane, retained us to move to a maintenance facility in Montpellier, France. There it was to undergo a heavy check before being leased out to a new operator, presumably on that side of the Atlantic. The M registration painted on the side is from the Isle of Man, a temporary transient registry much like Guernsey or Cayman registrations used as a flag of convenience for transitional operations between lessees. We stepped out of the old and directly into the new. Talk about a contrast, getting in the Airbus after roughing it over the past week with steam gauges was quite the change, a welcome change. I hadn't really thought about what it would feel like to hop right into an airliner because the A320 is so familiar, but the reduced workload in preparing the bus for flight was shockingly obvious. On several occasions, Bob and I looked at each other and said, "I feel like I'm forgetting something." We weren't, of course. There just isn't that much to do.
329 Russell Tower, wind 1707, runway 21, clear for takeoff. Turn left heading 010 to join J26.
Clear for takeoff. Left turn heading 010 to join the airway, Nomadic 329.
There we go.
Roger. Power set.
Cross.
Speed's alive.
After a short taxi, we were rolling down the runway at an appropriate height above the pavement and airborne for the first leg of a relatively short and easy trip across the Atlantic.
V1, rotate. V2.
In this business, anything less than 14 hours of flying in a day is cakewalk, and we lamented about how it's been a while since we've flown a transatlantic together.
What's for dinner, Bob?
L pizza.
Nomadic 329, contact Kansas Center 119.47.
119.47, Nomadic 329.
Cordero 3294, contact Kansas.
It looks like Sour Patch Kids and Cheetos to me.
That's what it was. We already had that. The appetizer.
Y'all forgot the frequency. 3347.
Yeah. So we had to go, we had to like go into selected here and call us at 8-1 because we have to make it before 9 p.m., which is 0200Z, which is exactly when we're landing. And that's when customs closes. So it's hard to say whether we're going to make it or be forced to overnight, but we're going as fast as we can.
Retard drive.
All right, we got it shut down. It is, we're 5 minutes late, but we're opening that door and we're gonna hope they're ready for us. They're not going to be happy.
It was 9 minutes past the hour when we opened the door, and we were immediately told that customs had closed and gone home. Confusion ensued for another 45 minutes, and we advised our operations that we'd missed the window and started packing it in for the overnight. Just before securing the main door, however, a customs agent pulled up to the aircraft, scolded us about being late, and proceeded to stamp our gen deck. To this day, I don't know what changed or why we were told otherwise, but we ended up getting out of there after what turned into a two-hour turn.
I can't believe that got processed. Here we are an hour and a half later, and they ended up staying open for us after all that freaking out.
Freaking out. And then after we sat on the ground here for 45 minutes, somebody said, "Hey, they're waiting for you."
329 Vanguard clearance clear to the Castle Lake Airport via the Bangor 5 departure radar vectors. Nils as filed. Maintain 10 south, squawk 3502.
At around 11 p.m. local, we picked up our clearance, started up, taxied out, and set out across the North Atlantic on a 4.5-hour leg to Keflavik. The entire leg would be flown under darkness, and despite an early morning arrival in Iceland, we wouldn't see the sun until sometime on the next leg down to Montpellier. It was mid-November, and this time of year in these latitudes, there's only dim sunlight for a couple of hours during the mid-afternoon. These extended stretches of night flying surely make for a challenging flight, and to combat tiredness, we keep each other on our toes by chatting, laughing, and taking turns wandering around the aircraft to keep the blood flowing. Not much scenery to take in on a night leg across the North Atlantic. As is normally the case these days with narrow-body ferry flights, we had to descend down to a lower cruising altitude since we lacked a satellite data link system. This is, of course, pre-planned, and the additional fuel burn is accounted for in advance during the planning stage. Before too long, we were descending into rainy, misty conditions in Kef and briefed up the ILS approach. By Iceland standards, the weather conditions were really pretty good. This time of year, it can get very ugly in Kef, with low ceilings, high wind, and ice to contend with.
We're in Kef.
It's 8:15 in the morning.
It is. Yeah. I know.
We went inside the ironically named South Air FBO to get some coffee, pay the handling bill, and of course sign the book, something we only do when filming for Cockpit Casual.
Well, what are you going to write, man?
Probably nothing.
I'll write something.
As usual, despite trying my best to write something prolific, I jotted down some generic, uninspiring words before heading back outside to the plane. Once in the cockpit, I overheard the C-17 crew parked next to us requesting a power back and quickly grabbed a camera and ran to the door. When an aircraft pushes back in reverse using its own reverse thrust, something we did long ago with the DC-9 and MD-80, and that you really no longer see anywhere outside of the military. The C-17 is a rugged machine built for the wild, so naturally it has this capability, and its crews are well trained to carry it out. You can see the rear cargo door open in this video, which is done so the loadmaster, on a headset, provides the all clear for the pilots up front, who obviously can't see behind them. I know I said this was a short ferry flight, and I stand by that for the most part, but by the time we rolled down the runway in Kef, we had technically been moving for 17 hours, including the ride to Roswell, so we were very much looking forward to seeing the sun to get that second wind we needed to get to the finish line. The sun rose as we crossed the North Sea southbound, heading towards the coast of Scotland, and boy, was it a beautiful sight.
I've always known that the Airbus is easy, but after spending the last week flying the West Wind,
yeah.
I mean, I forgot like how easy this really is. I mean, it's a joke. You don't trim it. I mean, there's really no flying skills involved. You follow the flight director. You don't touch the throttles after you set power until you pull them back for landing. I'm confident that I could take anyone, and probably make them into a pretty proficient Airbus pilot in about a week.
We took the handoff from Marseille and broke through the clouds to find a gorgeous clear day on France's southern coast. Bob maneuvered for a visual approach into Montpellier, our final stop in delivering this airplane into a heavy maintenance visit.
Thank you.
What, it's a lot of bricks coming out.
Two landings. We got two landings apiece. Well, that's that, man.
We did it. We're done. Now we got to figure out how to get to Paris.
We closed up the airplane and handed off the logbook, then hitched a ride with the tech rep to the main terminal, where we had about 3 hours before our flight to Paris.
Hey, Bob. Risotto.
We're at a very fancy, very well-known French restaurant here in Paris. It's called the Courtyard by Marriott. So we're eating something finally. We got to Paris. We're tired. We've been awake for like 35 maybe plus hours. What do you think? How long?
God, I don't.
So we woke up.
What time is it back home?
It's like in Roswell right now. It's like 2 p.m. So
I got up at like 6.
So 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32. We've been awake for 32 hours. What's your plan to get home?
I'm going to go get on United, go to Chicago on a 787, so it should be a good ride.
I'm going to go to Newark and then have to actually set up my car service to get home. So my flight's at 9:15 a.m., like 10, 11, 12 hours from now, maybe 11 hours from now. I'll get the hell out of here. Ready to be done.
This was a fun week.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a blast doing that training on the West Wind. Getting all that done, getting our types. It was fun doing the training. It was great getting the type finally after we've had it for a year.
I know, seriously, man.
Bob and I finished our beers and reflected on all the varied flying we'd done in the last week for another 20 minutes. After dinner, we retired to our rooms and finally climbed into real beds, and I was out cold within seconds. Ordinarily, this is where I'd wrap up the video with some footage of walking through the airport, maybe some shots from the business class cabin on my ride home, roll the credits, and say goodbye. But on this trip, there was still one more, I guess, adventure to come. The alarm was incredibly loud, and I shot up out of bed with my heart racing and absolutely no idea whatsoever where I was or what was happening. After a couple seconds, I figured it out. For real? I looked at the clock and it was 1 a.m. I'd only been asleep for a couple of hours. I cracked the door and saw scores of guests in their pajamas heading for the stairs. Damn it! I tried calling Bob from my room before I left, but no answer. Maybe he left his phone in the room. When I finally got outside, I called him again, repeatedly. No answer. We got word that it was a false alarm, and then we all filed back to our rooms.
Okay, so it's 1 o'clock in the morning. I was sound asleep and the hotel fire alarm went off and wouldn't go off and like was going off. I gave it at least a minute while I got 2 minutes while I got dressed and packed my backpack with everything that was truly important that I had with me. Left all this stuff. Oh my God, that was crazy. So I went all the way down 8 flights of stairs and met about probably 100 other people who just did the same thing. And I think I was the only one with a bag.
I did fall back asleep and got a few more hours of rest before heading back to the airport before the sun rose again. I did finally reach Bob at 8 a.m. from the lounge, and he had zero knowledge of the fire alarm and evacuation. Unreal. He slept through it. It's a damn good thing it was a false alarm. My ride home was uneventful, and once I got there, the entire experience felt like a blur. Between the West Wind ops and the Airbus ferry, I was away from home for about 10 days total on this one, which by our standards is a pretty long deployment. We didn't cover an insane amount of ground on this trip, and the ferry portion was as routine as it gets, but the contrast of flying our vintage bizjet with the A320 ops was incredibly memorable, and because of that, the trip was one I'll never forget. As it happened, the 757 trip into Roswell delayed a week later, and Bob and I ended up on separate trips in different parts of the world. The Westwind ended up spending two full weeks on the ramp in Roswell before I was able to fly back out with a friend of mine and pick it up. When I got back there, I wasn't sure if the battery would be dead or if the sitting meant the airplane would have problems, but I was thrilled when she fired right back up and gave us an uneventful flight back to our hangar in Wilmington, Delaware. Both Bob and I are really looking forward to operating the Westwind for years to come. People have asked if we're going to do any avionics upgrades, and the answer is, I don't think so. We both like the steam gauges, and everything works just fine. I'm confident that staying current on the Westwind is only going to improve and maintain our flying skills as the global fleet of airliners becomes simpler and simpler. We will be painting it, though, and I can't wait to show off what it will look like.